Тревожные новости приходят сейчас
из Луганска. Более
того,
украинская армия продолжает обстрел городов Юго-Востока.
Если Россия не примет срочных мер...
По сути дела, можно сказать, власть нас предала. Власть предала народ.
В как бы бездействии Москвы...
Затраты на Крым в ближайшие 5 лет будут исчисляться...
Может обойтись присоединение Крыма. Это порядка 3 миллиардов долларов в год.
The nationalists are feeling betrayed in eastern Ukraine and getting restless. The public is getting nervous about the costs of absorbing Crimea. The elite is getting jittery about the effects of sanctions, and the infighting among the Siloviki over the spoils of war is intensifying. After every party comes a hangover, and as we all know, hangovers are a bitch. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Brian. Hi, all.
And back with us from London after a long absence, also via Skype, is Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. Welcome back, Kirill.
Glad to join again.
Like the prodigal son. And also on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is another old school podcast stalwart returning to the fold, Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies. Welcome back, Sean.
Hello, everyone.
So we have Igor Girkin, aka Strolkov. We have him warning that if Vladimir Putin betrays the militants fighting to establish so-called Nova Russia in eastern Ukraine, he will share the fate of Serbian strongman Slobodan Milosevic. Alexander Dugin, the ideologist of the Nova Russia project, has said that, quote, many people feel themselves deceived as a result of Putin's refusal to use force in eastern Ukraine, and that Russian patriots are close to turning away from the Kremlin leader. And nationalist Mikhail Kalashnikov recently argued that the Kremlin has lost control over the process in eastern Ukraine, and that as a result, the uprising in Donbass could turn into an uprising in Russia. Comparisons have even been drawn in some circles to the fate of Tsar Nicholas II after Russia's defeat in the Russo-Japanese War. Mark, what do you think? Is this all hyperbole, or is there something to this? Has the Kremlin unleashed forces that are going to become a problem for them in the future?
Yes, but not necessarily in the ways that the likes of Dugin and so forth are claiming. I mean, it's clear that Putin had originally envisaged that this would be a relatively quick operation. Put a bit of pressure on Kiev by stirring up trouble in East Ukraine. Kiev will fold. The trouble can be sort of dampened back down. And everyone's happy, except for all Ukrainians who don't want to remain within Russia's sphere of influence, but he doesn't care about them. What's happened as the conflict has continued, and as Kiev either couldn't or wouldn't actually reach the sort of terms that Putin regarded as his minimum acceptable deal, is precisely that it has spun out of control. And increasingly, Russia faces the uncomfortable prospect of what is basically a civil war on its own doorstep, and a whole bunch of nationalists who suddenly have been given that most heady of things, a cause, something around which they can all unite and cohere in a variety of different types. So on the one hand, yes, absolutely, this is something that it's much, much harder for Moscow to actually control, especially if it wants to do so without leaving its own fingerprints really clearly sort of visible. But at the same time, I mean, I think we have to realize that nationalist fury, or ultra-nationalist fury, shall we say, is not something about which I think Putin needs to be excessively worried. I mean, these are people who have been fulminating for years. And on the whole, they get very little airtime. The Dugins, the Prokhanovs, who also one of these figures who sort of cropped up again out of nowhere. From time to time, it's convenient for the state to give them a platform. And when they're saying convenient things, or when it's convenient to be able to paint Putin as the moderate, you may think I'm extreme, but look at these barking lunatics who are off to my side, then that's fine, then they're trotted out. But they can just as easily be put back in the box, in my opinion. And I think that the sort of nationalism that we're seeing in mass terms is not a kind of desperate messianic bid for global imperial hegemony. this is not the same as Crimea. Crimea really did matter to people. Eastern Ukraine matters to a considerable extent because it's been orchestrated to matter. Mm. And it can just as easily be de-emphasized. And we see that in the media. We see that, in fact, there is a clear attempt to rein back, to actually paint figures like Strelkov as being less than the sort of the martial angels that they appeared. We had a particularly spiteful and stupid, but nonetheless significant interjection by Sergei Kurginyan, in which he more or less sort of implied that Strelkov was on the take, and rather foolishly said, "But come on, these guys have been given everything that they need; that they shouldn't be complaining." You know, what a way to basically prove everything that Ukraine has been saying about Russian support for the rebels. That's another matter. And so clearly, the Kremlin's backpedaling. We don't see the F word fascism on the TV anymore, and that kind of thing. You know, for all these ways, it's ratcheting it down. So I don't really think that Putin needs to lose too much sleep over whether or not Dugin's annoyed with him.
So you're saying this is not going to be a very nasty hangover. It's going to be a hangover, but one you can cure with a couple of ibuprofens.
I think the real hangovers hangover has nothing to do with the Dugins of this world. The real hangover are the big objective issues, like the fact of the lingering impact of sanctions, which may well be an extending impact of sanctions. The fact that you have precisely not just energized, but also alienated one particular fraction, but nonetheless, an active fraction of your support base, who it's not as if they're going to bring you down, but it means you can't rely on them in the future. And most importantly of all, it's hard to see how Putin, it's increasingly hard to see how Putin can come out of this with a real victory. Mm. Yes, whatever comes out of this, he will try and spin as mission accomplished.
Well, a Crimea.
Well, yeah, The problem is that each crisis, to an extent, supersedes and erases the last. Mm. Who remembers Sochi after Crimea? Well, likewise, we'll have to wait and see quite what happens in Ukraine. Mm. But unless there's some sort of dramatic turnaround, at best, I think Putin will come away with having looked like having a draw. Mm. And a lot of Putin's myth is based upon the fact that this is the man who never loses.
Right. I mean, I would add two things to this. You're right that he probably can put the Dugins of this world and the Strelkovs of this world back into the box. On the other hand, though, they've been fulminating forever. You're right about that. But there is this sense of the revolution of rising expectations, so to speak, applied just to the nationalists here. They have been given expectations. They were going to get Novorossiya. This is something they've been dreaming about since the collapse of the Soviet Union. They thought they were going to get it, and now they're not. Isn't that maybe going to make them a little bit dangerous? You combine that with an economy that is growing at near zero. It's 0.03% was the figure I saw the past
statistically
week.
Irrelevant, exactly.
Right. An economy that's basically growing is not growing and doesn't show any signs of growing in the near future. Is this combustible? Can this turn this hangover into something nastier than a hangover?
Combustible, I don't like the idea of that because, again, it implies something much more dramatic. I think it's more that it is a part of the growing decay of the sort of the Putinist order and thus the Putinist support base. Because let's face it, the nationalists have nowhere else to go. It's not as if they actually have some clear leader around whom they can cohere. And to be blunt, it's unlikely they're ever going to get that because the Kremlin would have to be deeply, deeply stupid to allow some kind of true ultra-nationalist Navalny to emerge or something like that.
And Navalny and these folks are not even close to being on the same page.
Precisely. It's a very different kind of nationalism we're talking about.
It's the imperialism.
So this is what I mean. It's not as if these are people who are going to become, in my opinion, an active threat. It's more that he loses a group who up to now were convened in a whole variety of ways, whether it was just as being part of the hurrah chorus, whether it was providing thugs to beat up people you don't like, or just simply it was just, it's useful to have a multitude of voices speaking in different terms about how wonderful you and your state is.
I mean, one thing I would like to know, I'm not even close to knowing the answer to this, but I don't know if any research has been done on this, but of the Navalny supporters, how much did Putin peel off those people with the Ukraine campaign? And I can't even venture a guess, to be honest. But it's something I would certainly like to know more about. Sean, how about a little bit of historical perspective? I mean, I've I've seen the Russo-Japanese War come up here and there as a metaphor. I've also even seen World War I, which we forget, initially did spark a wave of patriotism in the Russian Empire. I know you and I were talking off mic, and you think these analogies are a bit overstated. I tend to agree with you, but they're popping up in the nationalist press here and there. But could there be some sense of humiliation given the dashed expectations we're starting to see here? Is there anything history teaches about us about what we're about to see, maybe?
I don't think so, because I think despite Moscow having its fingers in eastern Ukraine, Russia's technically not at war.
Mm-hmm.
The population is not feeling the pressures of actually being at war. People aren't coming home. You know, their sons aren't coming home in body bags. The society isn't geared to war in any real economic sense. They're not feeling any pressures of it. So these kind of analogies, I mean, it is completely overstated. And I don't see any kind of humiliation, really, because I think Mark is right. A lot of the sentiment around what's happening in eastern Ukraine is manufactured in the media, and just by the fact how easily it's been dialed down suggests I wonder how much currency it actually has in Russian society in the first place. Yeah, people are going to get kind of wound up in the propaganda, but are they going to have any lasting feelings like, oh boy, we are a humiliated country, we lost Ukraine? And another thing with the Russo-Japanese War, I mean, there is a very big racist element to it, that the Russians lost to Japanese, who they saw as inferior. And this really was a statement of the decay of the system. And I don't see this being replicated in any sense. And just a comment about the nationalists and their kind of being upset with Putin and kind of turning on him. I think the nationalists misunderstand the relationship between the Russian state and Russian society in this case. Russian society is there to be mobilized by the administrative state. It's not there to be influenced by society in any way. The Kremlin uses society when it's necessary, and they don't really need to speak to it so much when society is bubbling up.
Right. Now, one place I do think the Russo – and your distinctions are well taken, but the one thing I do think where there is an analogy is the whole small victorious war metaphor that was originally – if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, but that was that originated with the Russo-Japanese War, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And one of the conventional wisdoms about the Ukraine campaign that's out there is that this was something that was done for domestic reasons, primarily, to create a situation that was going to boost Putin. It's done that. But now pulling back in eastern Ukraine, which Russia is clearly seems to be doing unless they change tacks tomorrow, is that going to reverse those gains, or will Putin be able to pocket those gains?
I think Putin has an advantage here, even if he dials back in the situation and the People's Republics fall. Because if you look at other frozen conflicts around the region, Transnistria, Abkhazia, South Ossetia, Russia has a really strong hand and influence in those regions. And there's a conflicts that have been going on, and not once has Russia really incorporated them, have given to the promises of given to the nationalists to incorporate those territories formally into the Russian Federation. They're just kind of de facto incorporate in any sense. And I think that Putin might be happy with just having eastern Ukraine kind of destabilized and Russia perhaps having a hand in that region in the future. Because the big question is, once the rebels are defeated militarily, how is Poroshenko going to govern eastern Ukraine?
Right.
And this is the big question.
How is he going to govern it, you mean?
Yes, how is he going to govern it?
Yeah. No, that is the big question. I mean, we're all watching Donetsk and Luhansk rather closely these days. Sticking on the domestic front, Kirill, a new book published this week, edited by Kirill Rogov, entitled The Crisis and Transformation of Russian Electoral Authoritarianism, argues that the Ukraine crisis was beyond doubt, and that's a quote, a turning point in Russian history, and that the level of political repression will only grow in terms of both their extent and intensity, and will increasingly become an inseparable part of the political culture of the Putin regime until this provokes an explosion. Is this correct? They're basically arguing that the Ukraine crisis marked the transformation from soft authoritarianism to hard authoritarianism, the final transformation of it, and that this is just going to reinforce itself and build on itself and feed on itself, and until there's an explosion. Is this correct? What did you think? I know you took a look at that.
I agree that the events of spring 2014 were one of the most important events in the latest history of post-Soviet Russia. But I'd like to say about not turning point, but turning period. The period, turning period began in the very end of 2011. And it lasted till the, you know, spring 2014. Mm-hmm. That is, I think, more correct and more accurate than speaking about turning point. So
well, this is to Rogov's credit. This is what he does argue. He starts the transformation, but the final turn took place.
In some sense, yes, of course, Russia, you know, never be the same again, of course, after Russian society, Russian state, never be the same again after, you know, all these events. But we must focus on all these events, from the first protests in December 2011 to the so-called Russian Spring 2014 as a whole process. That is...
It's interesting. That's the period we started this podcast, and it's
yes,
the whole period
yes,
of this podcast.
Yes,
so
we are very influential.
We've chronicled this.
maybe influenced, yeah. But so it started with a huge mass protests of, you know, not liberal, but sort of part of the society which was not agree with Putin and his regime. As you know, as you remember, these protests, they included, you know, and liberals and nationalists mm-hmm. and communists and whoever. So that was a sort of possibility of sort of, you know, national front against Putin regime. Mm-hmm. And it failed. And I think that the mistake of the opposition leaders was that they thought about this protest as a starting point of a sort of a new bright era of, you know, dissent and so on. And maybe, you know, the first starting point of new right Russia. But that was the end of the previous political period or season in Russian history, which began with the Orange Revolution and the first huge anti-Putin, not huge, but, you know...
The social protests.
Yeah, social protests in 2004. Mm-hmm. So that was 7 years of... We can define this 7 years as a sort of special political season.
I call it high Putinism, actually.
Yeah, maybe. Okay. And that was the end, not the beginning of the new. And then the reaction of Putin and the regime began. And he tried to, you know, to react like that was, you know, in the previous years, trying to consolidate his electoral base, trying to play with, you know, sort of anti-liberal and conservative and whatever parts of the society and so on. And that was the beginning of the end of his previous, you know, political agenda. And the end was in spring 2014. Putin mobilized all these parts of the society for the support of his policy against, you know, Ukraine and against liberals and so on. That was, you know, a sort of acme of his politics during this period. And after that, the hangover began. And this hangover, I think, this is the real beginning of a new political season now in Russia.
You mean the end of the Ukraine campaign is the beginning of a new season or the beginning
yes,
of the Ukraine
not the end of the, so we don't see the end of Ukrainian campaign. I see the end of the attempts to consolidate this nationalist and anti-liberal and so on part of the of Russian society. So now it's over. He took his, you know, 75, you know, 80%.
86.
Or 86 also, or whatever. So we don't believe in any, you know, opinion polls now in Russia, yet, like in the Soviet Union.
Even Levada has him at 86.
I'm a bit dubious about this.
I'm dubious of all opinion polls, but that's the most trustworthy one out there. Yeah. And as much as you can measure public opinion in a society like that, and judging from the baselines we had before, where the same polls, reliable polls, were showing him in the high 40s, low 50s, he definitely got a boost in public opinion. There's no question about that.
Let's agree on
the 80%. Numbers we can quibble with, but
okay, 80%. But he will never reach more, and that is,
I don't know how he can.
Yes,
yes. he's not going to go to 100. I mean,
that is, yes, 146. Yes, as you know, this legendary result. But after that peak, the only way is down.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the real sort of real meaning of all these events. That is that, you know, every or almost every player in this game understood or still understanding its own limitations. Liberals understood their own limitations, you know, 1 year ago, and still understanding that their influence is very limited. Is not, you know, very, their ideas are not such popular and so on. And they have to work now, from now on, in these particular limitations. After that, now nationalists, they are understanding the limitations of their influence on the Kremlin. And Kremlin itself is understanding its own limitations inside the society, and especially outside Russia.
Well, this is what this, I mean. You've given us a lot to chew there on there, Kirill, and thanks. It's good to have you back. I mean, because you do paint an interesting picture here. You paint a society that was out of equilibrium, so to speak, a political system that was out of equilibrium from late 2011 until the present day. I guess it's almost like, you know, and Putin to get his footing back had to have the society on this kind of constant, permanent mobilization mode almost from this time. It's the only time he's really had his footing. Can this system settle into equilibrium under this regime? Or under what circumstances can this settle into a new equilibrium again?
Somehow, I think that this autumn, so I can predict, even I can predict that this autumn Putin will try to put in balance the society and the political system.
Can he, though?
I'm speaking that he will try to do this.
Or are we going to move from spectacle to spectacle to spectacle to spectacle?
I'm not sure. It's up the several, you know, several things. First of all, of course, it's a situation in Ukraine. First of all, no one knows what will happen next there. Secondly, a situation with the Russian economy. And thirdly, I think the situation inside the regime itself. So in some sense, when we are thinking about such figures like, you know, this Girkin, Strelkov, and all this, you know, Borodais and so on, I can't resist the feeling that we see now a sort of uprising of the low-level KGB agents.
Mm.
It looks like that they are now out of control, in some sense out of control. And just imagine if they will be defeated definitely or eventually in Ukraine and they will return to Russia. I'm not sure that they will live up the expectations of Putin and his cronies to live a low-key life somewhere in Novosibirsk or Rostov-on-Don and so on. So I think the very existence of all these people, and there are hundreds and hundreds of these people, is a quite destabilizing, you know.
Well, and we're going to talk about the Siloviki and the infighting, the inevitable infighting in the second half. Now, Mark and Sean, why don't you guys jump in, because Kirill's given us a lot to chew on here, and kind of looking at this as this one extended period, and that's been in constant kind of permanent mobilization, upheaval, high Putin. It's like the long death of high Putinism, if you can put it into the long revival of high Putinism. I'm not sure which. What do you guys think?
Well, I would say, I mean, the point you made before about mobilization and sort of Putin relying on mobilization, I mean, in many ways we see a constant tension between two modes of control of society. Very broadly speaking, alienation or mobilization. Either creating crises and spectacles to try and draw people in essentially into a political soap opera that allows people to feel part of things without actually in any way having any traction on the policy process. Or alternatively, an alienation that just gets people to think, well, there's nothing we can do anyway. Broadly speaking, the Vlasti, the powerful, they're running things okay, but even if we didn't like it, there's nothing we can do, so let's just live our daily lives. Either way, it's essentially a narrative for telling people, this is why you do not actually get involved in politics, this is why you don't expect to have any control over politics. And I do think that there is going to be this dilemma. And I'm not quite sure if I would agree that sort of Russia will never be the same again, but I think we can say that Putin will never be the same again. You know, he is, depending on quite what happens in Ukraine, going to have to make a choice. whether he continues in the mobilization approach, which, yes, will mean that he'll have to find new enemies, new exciting spectacles or something, and I don't think the World Cup preparations are going to quite cut it. Or, the BRICS, conversely...
What about the BRICS summit? It's coming up this next week.
Well, I must admit, we are all agog. But you know, alternatively, he needs to find some ways of basically getting people passive once again.
But that... Let me interrupt you for a second, though, Mark. But the passive like strategy, what you call the alienation strategy, that works when living standards are rising. That doesn't work in an economy that's at zero growth.
Not necessarily. I question whether there is actually a direct correlation. I mean, the same way as broadly speaking, when the economy is hard in democratic societies, people vote for conservatives who tell the poor that it's their fault. And actually, it's when the economy is doing okay that people feel optimistic and are much more likely to vote for liberal or leftist approaches. I mean, I think actually, if people are busy scrabbling to get by, yes, it means that there is often going to be a potential reservoir of anger that if someone comes along or some event comes along that is able to tap into that reservoir, it suddenly all bursts out. But the point is, if you can prevent anything like that from happening, then actually most people are fairly, well, actually, that's one of the few things that the Kremlin is pretty good at, is treading on people as soon as they start to become sort of potentially noticeable. It can't deal with this thing on a societal level, but actually on an individual level, it's quite. I think it's learned the lessons of Navalny. It's not going to allow people come up who might become potential catalysts. But I mean, I think the last point I want to make is actually on this figure Strelkov, who I think is actually sort of quite fascinating, in part because he is somewhere between a caricature and a poster child of Putinism. In some ways, he is exactly what I imagine, you know, young Putin would have dreamed of being. You know, he is this terribly sort of disciplined, measured, self-controlled, ruthless, effective figure who actually has done extraordinarily well as a leader in that context, largely through a combination of ruthlessness and force of will. I mean, you know, we've seen the recent sort of revelations about the courts martials and people being killed for looting.
The BuzzFeed story.
I mean, absolutely. And I'm not a fan of the death penalty under any circumstances, especially not when it's revolutionary troikas committing it. But let's be blunt, that is actually how you deal with looting, is you have a few horrendous example cases and the word gets out. There's no point in trying to think, well, we actually have to have a sliding scale. Yeah, I mean, I think this is it. You know, Strelkov clearly is the sort of person who has no problem grasping nettles. He clearly believes himself to be part of some grand heroic narrative that is based on a kind of a Russian vision, which is larger than any one leader, any one regime, any one country. You know, these are all really Putinist
you're
things.
You're saying Putin's reliving his adolescent fantasies vicariously through Strelkov?
No, I think quite the opposite. I think Putin is being bitten by his own adolescent fantasies. Uh-huh. In some ways, Strelkov is, I hesitate to say Putin's child, because that brings a very, very dubious image to it. but definitely, I mean, in some ways, you know, Strelkov is the archetype of the kind of Putin Russian, a homo Putin. And now Putin's finding out just how actually deeply, deeply inconvenient it is to have someone like that.
Sounds like
now
a great blog post for you to do on in Moscow's shadows.
I'll bear it in mind.
Sean, what do you think?
In terms of the mobilization as a characteristic of Putinism, I think this is definitely clear, especially since the Orange Revolution. We've seen Putin on a war footing ever since. There's a constant mobilization, attempt to mobilize society. There's a constant attempt to kind of keep it on edge against internal and external enemies. And that has really gone all the way up to the present. And the Kremlin has been good about controlling these types of figures, dialing down when necessary, ratcheting it up when it's necessary. But these men with guns in the eastern part of Ukraine, the Strelkovs, but also just the irregulars that have flooded across the border into Ukraine or now have guns in their hands, what is Putin going to do with these people once they're ran out of Ukraine?
Yes, this is...
Is he going to let them into Russia? And if he does, they become a very big potential destabilizing force.
And Mark seems to think we can put him back in the box, right? No?
This is a good question. If he can't put him back in the box, because to put them back in the box, you have to get the guns out of their hands.
Right.
And
if they were armed by, I mean, a lot of them, we put an interview up today with one of these separatist fighters, and gave a lengthy interview to our Russian service, amazingly, which gave an incredible amount of detail about like things like the siege of the airport in Donetsk. I would highly recommend everybody take a look at it. The interview was conducted by our Russian service. But this guy's back in Russia now. He's been, decommissioned, so to speak. He's not armed anymore. They took his gun away when he came back. So I'm not sure if this one example is how this is going to work for everybody. But it's, people are returning.
Yeah, but you might have a contingent of a small hardcore that now kind of beaten back, disgruntled the fact that the Kremlin didn't come and save them militarily. Here I think the nationalist backlash might be a problem by virtue of the fact that these people might have weapons. This is the kind of one danger that I see is how do you the Kremlin can dial down society's kind of patriotic fervor and kind of return to a normalcy. Though I must say, the next possible mobilization is around the elections coming up in September.
The
local elections. I don't know how much effort the Kremlin will be to kind of get society ratcheted up to vote, but this is certainly going to be another point. After that, who knows what kind of – if they're going to keep a mobilized footing or move back to what Mark was talking about, the kind of alienation moment, it remains to be seen. But I think trying to dial down these kind of hardcore people who have been fighting in eastern Ukraine and now have a kind of war ethos about them, how they're going to be put back in the bottle, I think, is a question.
What do you – Mark, go ahead.
I don't say about putting them back in the box. I mean, I think there's two separate issues we're talking about. I'm more sanguine about the capacity to control them in terms of taking their guns off them, not allowing them back on the wall. I mean, the Russian border, for all that it has been mysteriously porous over recent months in terms of people flowing one way, it is a highly controlled border. And if they're precisely going to be aware, they are going to be searching people's, cars and suitcases and whatever else. You cannot just easily mosey across the border with an assault rifle and an RPG-7. So it's not that I think we're talking about necessarily sort of armed insurgents. And anyway, you can always get guns in Russia. That's not too problematic. But where I would agree that there's a problem is them as a politically mobilized force. I mean, in some ways, they're sort of the Freikorps. You can draw the German parallel, with in Russia, exactly. People who have been through the fire, have this war ethos, also feel betrayed. The point is, I mean, there's still a relatively handful considering the size of this country. The question is whether or not actually they become the kind of movement that other people will flock to, mm-hmm. whether they can just simply be isolated politically. So I think we're talking about a political versus a kind of a security concern, are two separate issues.
Another thing that's kind of come across my mind in this as well is what, I mean, we've spoken on this podcast in the past about the difference between the ethnic nationalism of a Navalny and the kind of imperial state nationalism that Putin seems to promote. And you have to wonder if the Kremlin's nationalist problem in the broader sense is going to come back. I mean, these ethnic nationalists have been quiet throughout this. You're not hearing about them as much. And I'm wondering how many of these are the same people at the rank and file level or not. I haven't seen any good sociological studies on that. But is the Kremlin's, broadly speaking, nationalist problem going to come back, the ethnic nationalism problem? No.
Well, I don't know who that was directed to, but I would say that I very much doubt that the kind of rank and file people who are currently clutching Kalashnikovs in Donetsk have a great degree of nuance as to what kind of nationalism they believe
precisely.
In. Precisely. And I'm sure that they're much more likely to be thuggish ethnic Russian nationalists rather than anything else. But again, the issue is one of mobilization. I think they're people who could be mobilized one way or the other, theoretically, into Russian culture and the glories of the Russian state, or what are all these damn dirty Azeris doing on our streets? Either of them is possible, but it depends on who mobilizes them.
Let me throw a hypothetical out at you that just popped into my head then. I mean, we all know there's a bunch of cases against Navalny floating through the courts for this, that, and the other thing. I'm not going to catalog them, but at some point, the Kremlin's going to reach a decision of whether they're going to put him away or not, right? Last time they did that, he put a lot of people on the streets of the capital. Could he do it again? And could some of these people be disgruntled people coming back from Eastern Ukraine? And what does that portend? Just a hypothetical, maybe hyperbole. What do you think? Kirill, go ahead.
I think it's a question, we already discussed it several times, it's a question of a new political and social agenda in Russian politics. It's not, from now on, it's not about, you know, some liberal values or even about corruption or something like this. This new political and social and economical agenda must be about absolutely different real things, in which different groups of population, doesn't matter, are they, you know, against the occupation of Crimea or, you know, supporting it or something like this. So that is the most important question. If someone, you know, say Navalny or some nationalist leaders or whoever will invent, define, and suggest to the population, to the society, you know, some new slogans, some new ideas, which are, you know, based in the very ground of Russian life. In this case, you know, we will see a reappearing of Navalny and all the protests and so on.
Well, this is what I'm, I mean, last summer, the time I felt the regime looked the most, the weakest, the most wobbly and the most vulnerable was during the whole Navalny fiasco last summer when they put him away and then they let him go and he returned, you know, triumphantly on a train and gave a stirring speech. That all started because he was able to put a lot of people on the streets. Can he do that again? That makes me wonder. Sean, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, that is also comes into context where opposition forces were mobilized. And at this point, opposition forces are not mobilized. In fact, they're completely deflated. They're almost non-existent outside of the kind of things they're trying to do to get on the local ballots for the Moscow City Council. Right. But for the most part, there is no kind of formation that Navalny could tap into, and I really don't think that he could rapidly create one because he's basically been off the radar for the last several months.
He's been tweeting a lot, but he's been off the radar.
Sure, okay, fine. he could tweet all day long, but the kind of real forces that were behind him don't exist at the moment, and whether they can ratchet up again is a big question.
Mm-hmm. Mark, would you agree?
Yeah, I can't see Navalny either being willing or able to reach out to these new constituencies. If he's going to be freed and if he's going to set up, he's going to have to basically start from scratch, and he's going to have to start with his base. And I don't see how he can kind of link his base with tattooed hard men who've just come back from Eastern Ukraine without completely changing his perspective.
So he's going to
and
go
if
quietly.
He does that, that's a point where he becomes dangerous again.
Right.
And again, I think that's a point where the Kremlin steps on him.
Kirill, last word.
I think it's possible somehow to connect Navalny to all these people who will or would return from Ukraine. This is the problem of injustice. If he will speak about, you know, some injustice, which is, you know, doing against all these people who were fighting, maybe erroneously, but anyway, mistakenly, but anyway, fighting for Russia, and now they're, you know, just threw away and so on, in this case, they will be, you know, the allies.
Yeah. Yeah, and one has to remember he was opposed to this whole business from the start and very vocally as vocal as he can be under house arrest and publicly. All right, well, in a few minutes, we'll continue our discussion and pick Mark's big brain about how the Siloviki are fighting over the spoils of the Ukraine crisis. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also on the Skype line from London is Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Министр обороны Сергей Шойгу доложил президенту Владимиру Путину о результатах...
На обострение ситуации на юго-востоке Украины заявил сегодня министр обороны Сергей Шойгу.
Российский вице-премьер Дмитрий Рогозин в очередной раз заявил, что место Молдовы в таможенном союзе.
Подразделение российской армии.
спецназе ГРУ.
Громкий скандал разгорается в управлении Б, Главного управления экономической безопасности.
Владимир Путин отправил в отставку руководителя антикоррупционной службы.
Mark, you had a really interesting piece this week in Foreign Policy about how the GRU, which was on the ropes for much of last year, has revived its fortunes in the Ukraine crisis. And this is just one of the ways that Siloviki land appears to be being reconfigured to a degree. We have the long-standing struggle between Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu and Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Rogozin. We see it intensifying, with Shoigu appearing to gain a distinct advantage. And as you wrote in Russia Magazine recently about the ongoing turf battle, or as you get to describe it, the, quote, bloody soap opera, at the Interior Ministry's main directorate for fighting economic crime and combating corruption. That's a mouthful. I've been handing you the mic a lot in the second half lately to chronicle the ongoing drama in Siloviki land, but I think with good reason. This is pretty important. And if we want to wrap our brains around where things might be headed, we got to wrap our brains around a lot of this. So humor me again, Mark, and humor our listeners. And what are we seeing going on in Siloviki land?
In many ways, it's a perfect example of the extent to which Russian politics is the politics of the court. And therefore, what really matters are, first of all, utility. Demonstrating your utility to the guy or the guys at the very top. And secondly, how can you monetize or sort of gain resources from your positions, your power, and so forth? Those really are the two key dynamics. I mean, if you look at, for example, the way that the GRU, military intelligence, has seen its fortunes flip round, you know, for a long time, it did not seem to be useful. Its main responsibilities were within the post-Soviet space, and there it was not covering itself with glory. In the 2008 invasion of Georgia, it was generally regarded as having been lackluster at best. It wasn't really essentially able to prove that it had value. And the trouble is military intelligence is often in a particularly problematic position because there's not much money to be made out of that. And therefore, there was talk of it being relegated down to a mere ordinary directorate of the general staff instead of a main directorate, which if you happen to have stars on your epaulettes, that's the kind of distinction that matters a lot. They lost lots of their senior officers and that kind of thing. But then what actually happened is Russia found itself in a war that it hadn't for some years. It may be an undeclared war. It may be a covert third-party war, but it is a war nonetheless. And all of a sudden, this actually proved to be precisely the kind of war, and this is something we talked about in a previous podcast, that the GRU is really very good at. It has control over special forces, even though most of the Spetsnaz are technically now part of the kind of the regular army. It has a greater willingness to carry out these kind of, one could call them swashbuckling, but anyway, more high-risk operations outside of Russia's borders, kinetic operations, i.e. ones which involve shooting people. All of these things, which once upon a time were not seen as particularly useful from the Kremlin's point of view, suddenly now seem very useful indeed. So externally, I mean, I think what we see is that the services that can demonstrate that they actually can do something to extend Russian power are doing quite well. But also strikingly, in terms of external politics, they're all trying to make a point of proving that they can play well with others. It's a little bit like what happened over Sochi, in that we know all the various agencies hate and resent and are constantly in competition with each other. But nonetheless, everyone was very, very keen to show that they were sharing information with each other over Sochi, because there was the terror that if something had gone wrong, if there had been some terrorist act, then who would have been the scapegoat in the subsequent inquest? And whoever seemed not to have been handing on information or similar would have been in real trouble. But likewise, at the moment, we have the FSB, the Federal Security Service, we have the SVR, Foreign Intelligence Service, we have the GRU, we have the Interior Ministry, all of which are involved in Ukraine, and all of which actually are making a big deal of showing that they are kind of collegiate and useful. Because, firstly, they want to avoid the risk of Putin getting annoyed with them, and secondly, because there's a lot of resources into whoever can show that they're part of this new non-linear war. But, and this is the last point I'd make, internally it's very different. Internally, at the moment, shall I say, there is no war. Sochi's over, there's no kind of clear, serious threat, and therefore the Siloviki are coming out to play. And the struggle over this ludicrously named directorate within the Interior Ministry is precisely because of utility and value. That on the one hand, you have a directorate which, because we know that the Kremlin loves to nail its enemies with claims of fraud and tax evasion, you know, it's actually, if you can control that, then you become the Kremlin's go-to repressor. But also, actually, that's one of the departments where if you have control over that, you have massive opportunities for making money through all kind of corrupt deals. Mm. And therefore, this is why it's a particularly sanguinary sort of conflict we're getting. So, as it were, the natural state of affairs within Silovik land is war amongst each other. It's only when they have an external enemy to fight that they suddenly find themselves at peace. It's a little bit like Afghans, one would say.
I never thought I'd see something acronym, the GUEBIPK, becoming a feared organization that everybody's fighting
there
over.
There is nothing you can do with that acronym.
There is nothing
to make
at all
it,
you can do with that acronym except point out how ridiculous it is. I mean, it's interesting that you say the GRU has become, they're kind of the curators of this new kind of, it's not so new, but nonlinear warfare the Kremlin's waging. And if this is going to become a primary foreign policy tool of the Kremlin, is the GRU's rise a long-term, quasi-permanent thing, or is the FSB going to come back to its rightful or long-standing place as the leading branch of the security services?
I think this is a long-term thing for a variety of reasons. One is because exactly the Kremlin has realized, even if, as it were, there are clearly problems with the current conflict in Ukraine, it's not a perfect success. I think the Kremlin realizes that this kind of asymmetric conflict is really the only way it can truly push its efforts against not even sort of Western countries or whatever, but even if you look at somewhere like Kazakhstan, if they're, and you know, there's a prospect of when Nazarbayev dies, the succession might become a problematic issue. Considering that China is also sitting there, this is not a situation in which actually the Russians could really contemplate sending in mass military force without there being a potential for a very nasty diplomatic, if not even more serious, response. So I think for all these kind of reasons, this kind of, you know, covert, overt, deniable political conflict is definitely the way of the future. And yeah, the GRU is precisely, as you say, the sort of the curators of that. And I don't think the FSB will be able to wrench it from them. Firstly, because it's just not what they do. But secondly, I mean, one thing we have seen is that Putin, as a veteran of the agencies, he does understand them. He understands them in a way that few other leaders do. And one of them is he understands the natural dynamic towards empire building. Every time the FSB, which is clearly the senior service, has tried to swallow up one of its major rivals, like the Foreign Intelligence Service, which would basically recreate the KGB, Putin has not allowed that to happen. He's trailed the idea because it's a good way of getting the SVR worried and a good way of getting the FSB for a while happy. But he knows that it will create an agency it would be very, very difficult for him to control. Mm. And also, that kind of omnifunctional agency actually doesn't work very well. Mm. So, I mean, I think for all these reasons, Putin will have a very good incentive to keep these agencies separate. So, you know, we're not going to see sudden, massive shifts in the topography of the Russian intelligence community.
Now, the other thing that caught my attention, and I know off mic you didn't seem to think this was such a big deal, but I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on it. The long-standing struggle between Shoigu and Rogozin, and Rogozin seems to be getting slapped down right now, and Shoigu's stock seems to be rising. Is there anything you can say to that? Is there anything significant going on here at all?
In some ways, I feel that this represents not so much them or even their political struggle, but actually just the nature of the institutions they represent. Shoigu represents, at the moment, the soldiers. Rogozin, more than anything else, represents the defense industrialists. We've seen a situation in which, however covertly, the soldiers have been doing their job, and they've been doing it well. I mean, the political calculations behind it may well prove to have been faulty. But if you look at how Crimea was taken, and indeed the stirring up of eastern Ukraine, I mean, in a way, the military has done everything that it was charged to do. Whereas on the other hand, we've had a series of problematic sort of non-launches and such like from the defense industry sector. And we also have the fact that there is actually the real struggle has been between the generals and the defense industrialists, because the generals don't want what the defense industrialists want to sell them. And the defense industrialists just want to sell more of the same things that they sell before. Mm. And on the whole, actually, it's the latter who have had the Kremlin's ear. So a lot of the military kit is not really what the generals want. And again, I think this is one of these situations that you particularly get in times of peace.
Right.
Now, time of war is a situation where the generals are in a much stronger position to say, no, instead of just unloading the junk you need to keep factories running, actually, we need the following bits of kit urgently. Right. So, I think it's, you know, it's not so much Shoigu or Rogozin as two individuals. Mm. I have no idea what their human dynamic is like. But anyway, I mean, they are two you know, worlds apart figures within. In some ways, they are the poles.
Yeah.
Of the Russian political system, yeah. the absolute sober technocrat and the sort of flamboyant showman.
Yeah.
But it's more that they just happen to represent interests which are basically very heavily sort of slanted against each other.
Yeah, I've seen stuff in the press that Putin's kind of getting sick of Rogozin and his antics, and that he really doesn't want to suffer him anymore. But we'll see if there's anything to that. Sean or Kirill, anything you want to add or any question you might have for Mark? Because it's kind of start turning the second half into the Mark show. All right, before we wrap it up, one last thing I wanted to throw out there is like, We a lot of what we've been talking about through this entire podcast is how the whole system's in flux right now, and what we've been seeing in Ukraine over since the spring has been another stage of that flux. What does the new normal look like? What do we think? Do we have any expectations about what the new normal is going to eventually look like, or is there going to be a new normal? Don't all jump at once.
Well, I mean, I would say I think precisely there is no new normal. I think this is the problem that Putin has lost his early two presidencies' mojo. He's lost that particular role. I mean, in part because times have changed, in part because he has changed. He's tried to create a new model, the nationalist Putin, and basically turn politics into the nationalist Putin show. And that's currently not going so well. I don't think he ultimately can row back. And therefore, I think we're probably going to see a variety of stopgap measures as he tries something else and tries something else. Doesn't necessarily mean they're all going to be kind of aggressive foreign policy excesses or anything like that, but just simply he himself is unlikely, in my opinion, to be able to reach some new stability.
Anybody else? Yeah, Kirill, go.
I think there will be, you know, three, maybe four main problems this autumn. First of all, as I told, that it's a question of a new balance, new political balance in the Russian state and Russian society. And I think that Putin is thinking or, you know, trying to put the system into a sort of balance this autumn. And we will see the interesting sign will be during and after local elections in Moscow, of course. Second point is that I absolutely agree with Mark that Putin is failing two important things. First of all, in previous period, he was trying to, and successfully tried to, play a sort of dealer between
the
managers and shareholders, between various forces in the system and so on. And now he's trying, as I understand from what Mark was saying, he's trying to play with several institutions inside Russian state, which is different. It's very narrow. He's not playing with, businessmen, siloviki, managers, and so on. He's trying to play inside very narrow sector of Russian, even of Russian state. He's just quite abandoned the idea of, understanding how, oligarchs still thinking about what's going on and so on. But the threat is that all these institutions like FSB and all of them, they're just not, of course, they're not just instruments or tools and something like this, but they don't have their own political, in the whole sense of this word, political interests. It's not politics. It's just trying to play some sort of Secret Service administrative game inside the Russian institutions and so on. And while forgetting about the interests of some other very powerful, by the way, groups of Russian society, he's, you know, put himself in sort of danger. And third point, of course, it's a future of Russian opposition. I absolutely agree with Sean that, you know, in some sense, Russian opposition doesn't exist anymore, of course. And they have to reinvent somehow themselves, or nationalists and some other forces, they reinvent themselves as a Russian opposition instead of liberal opposition or instead of, you know, serious opposition and so on. And that will be disastrous for Russian politics and Russian society.
Sean, any last words?
Yeah, you know, since Putin came back to the presidency, he's played a lot of cards. He played the internal enemies. He's played the external enemies. He's played the nationalist card. He's played the Sochi. And he's been playing Ukraine. And the question is, what does he have left? And I think the only way we can see a new normal kind of emerging is either A, the new normal is just kind of malaise, a kind of back off of you know, provoking society and kind of leaving it alone and
stagnation,
just kind of stagnation, kind of bobbing along and having no real agenda. Or perhaps society will give Putin something to ratchet to be engaged again. Or maybe there might be an international incident. These are the only things that I can – since I think Putinism itself kind of maintains itself on a war footing, and we've seen that since at least 2004, as we said, it needs to have another kind of needs to have another thing to base this war footing on, this kind of constant mobilization. And really the question is, what will be the next mobilization?
Yeah, that's what I'm expecting, is kind of a permanent mobilization. Well, that unfortunately is all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFARL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow has been Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia Security Services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also on the Skype line from London has been Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies. Thank you, gentlemen, for the fascinating discussion.
Thank you.
It's been fun.
And I'd also like to thank our patient, brilliant, and overworked producer, Tanya Konchova, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.